listener, and welcome to yet another episode of the Zeitgeist Tapes, in which me, Stephen Fielding, and my co-presenter, Emma Burnell, hello Emma.
Hi Steve.
Dissect in a friendly, sometimes critical, but always informed way, examples of when politics and culture collide, usually a film, because it's easier to watch, sometimes a TV series, sometimes a novel, but that, you know, we tend to avoid novels. And we just
we've done plays.
We've done plays, and Emma is a playwright, knows what a play looks like, so we're really, you know, we're in the fast lane on that front. If you've listened to us before, listener, you will know what we do, so no introductions are absolutely necessary. Now, it being, I don't know when you're going to listen to this, listener, but it's at a couple of weeks before Christmas. Everyone's saying, oh, it's Christmas. Manchester, where I'm from, is stinking with mulled wine, which probably most city centres and town centres are stinking with from their German market, where all the people from Holland and the Czech Republic come and sell tat at highly expensive rates. So, you know, we usually have a Christmas theme to an episode that we, you know, do at this time of year. And to this one is some exception, I think, because to coincide with the lamented, unlamented, sad, happy demise of Henry Kissinger, I remembered in the dim and distant recesses of my mind that there was a film in which Henry Kissinger was kind of played by Walter Matthau. And it happened to be one of my favourite films, so I just suggested to Emma we might want to talk about this film.
And I do worry about you, Steve.
Why?
I mean, it's not a bad film. It's a very, very good film. But if this is one of your favourite films, what do you do? Put it on every Sunday and like, oh, yay, it's so depressing.
The depressing film, apparently depressing film, is in fact Failsafe, which was made in came out in 1964, directed by one of the best post-war Hollywood directors, Sidney Lumet. Mm. And yes, Emma's kind of right. I mean, when it's available on Amazon Prime, and on Amazon Prime, they, to help the person choose the film, they give it kind of, you know, four sort of keywords. And the four keywords which Amazon Prime use for Failsafe are suspense, drama, bleak, cerebral. And it's all of those. It's all of those, really. Although, is it as bleak as it might appear? I don't know. I don't know.
I mean, given that we have a all the spoilers rule on this podcast, yes, it ends with two cities being nuked.
Yes, but the world avoids a complete conflagration.
That is right? True.
Yes. So let me just set it up for you, listener, because probably like 99.9%, I mean, that's an underestimate of the number of percentage of people who haven't ever seen or heard of this film. Failsafe is, cutting to the chase, is very much like Dr. Strangelove, but not played for laughs. In fact, it's based on a novel that in the end it was accused of plagiarizing the book that Dr. Strangelove was based on, which led to some legal agreement that Dr. Strangelove would come out at the start of 1964. And the arrangement was that only after Dr. Strangelove had stopped being shown in cinemas, then Failsafe could be put on. And given that Dr. Strangelove was incredibly popular and did very, very well as a comedy, then it took it was like the very end of 1964 that the film came out. So the film is, like I say, just like Dr. Strangelove, i.e. accidentally, in Failsafe, it's an accident of technology that leads an American nuclear bomber fleet to start going to Moscow. It's an accident. The Americans don't mean to do it. And thanks to the Russians' technology intervening, stopping the Americans being able to contact the crew until it's way too late, the crew think World War III has started and are going off to bomb, as dutiful American airmen, to bomb Moscow. So the film is mostly about trying to stop them doing it and the negotiations between the American president, who's played by Henry Fonda. I mean, he's at a certain point in history, he was everybody's ideal American president, Henry Fonda. You would want Henry Fonda to be your president. And in this film, Henry Fonda, who is...
with the possible exception of Jane Fonda, who wasn't that keen on him, certainly at that point.
Yeah, well, but, you know, daughters, fathers, you know, we can let her off that one. So he's trying his best in a very small room, helped only by the Russian translator, who's played by babyface Larry Hagman, to negotiate. Well, first of all, to discover, no, we can't stop this bomber going off, and then negotiating with the Russians a deal which means that World War III will not start. So the Russians have to be persuaded it's an accident. It's not the start of anything that's going to happen. You know, it's not the start of a wider attack. And then they've got to work out, well, if you can't shoot down all the bombers that are going to get through to Moscow, what do we do then? And so Henry Fonda, the American president, has negotiates with the Russians. And to be fair to the film brings out that the Russians aren't as bad as Americans. The Americans aren't as bad. You know, everybody's trying to solve this problem of technology, nuclear technology.
Well, except for Walter Matthau's character.
Which we will get to. Yes, obviously. The deal is, if a bomber gets through and it does drop, you know, 2 megaton bombs on Moscow, well, the Americans will drop 2 megaton bombs on New York, and you know, and there's a way in which the Russians can know that that's done. So it's kind of equally, we've done it to you, we're going to do it to ourselves, just to show
to equality. Even the balance and show that it's not a start of a war that would then end with the whole world being killed.
Yes. So in that sense, Emma is completely right. It's a bit bleak, but it ends on, if anything, a slightly high note, that the American president and the Russian premier decide, we can't do that. We can't go through this again. We need to do something. And that's, you know, that is the end. 6 million people in New York, maybe the same number of people in Moscow, are dead, including the president's wife, because they couldn't tell anybody what they were going to do.
Deliberately gets the ambassador to Moscow to sit in the room in Moscow, and the signal that the bomb has gone off is a high-pitched tone that means the phone has melted,
as has the American ambassador.
That's the implication, yes. Certainly.
Yeah. So yes, it's a very, it's, and given it comes out in 1964, and I guess Dr. Strangelove playing it for laughs, exact same scenario, really, played for laughs, is just, you know, did really kill, it killed the audience for Failsafe, really, I think. And when I first discovered that this film existed, I'd seen Dr. Strangelove, you know, a couple of times. It was always being shown on TV for a period. And so I knew it quite well. And I just couldn't believe you could make a serious version. I thought, that's ridiculous. So when I first watched it, it was with some degree of skepticism, but it is an incredibly intense film.
It's an incredibly intense film. It's incredibly intensely well acted as well. Yeah. Like, all of the characters are very nuanced and believable. The interaction, particularly between Henry Fonda and Larry Hagman, because they're alone together in this small room with the direct line to the Russian president. And Hagman is asked by Fonda, Buck, I think, Hagman's name, is asked by him to not just interpret the words, but say how the emotions are being expressed as well. You know, is he sad? Is he optimistic? Is he hopeful? Really, really interesting. And of course, they sort of slightly talk about some of the decisions that the president is coming to, because this is literally the only other human being in the room while he's deciding to bomb New York, where his wife is, and while he's deciding to bring the ambassador in to his death and not send him to a safe place.
Yes.
So
I mean, it's like a play, isn't it? I mean, it is very cerebral. Amazon got that right. I mean, most of the action, such as it is, although this involves two atomic conflagrations, it really takes place in three rooms, doesn't it? I mean, there's a little tiny room with the president, the translator, and the phone. You know, he's talking in a phone on the phone or hearing things through an intercom, and then there's the Pentagon where the Secretary of State for Defense and all of his officials and advisors are gathered for another reason, but they're there and at the end of the phone. And then there's Strategic Air Command, which, you know, ultimately is the cause of all of this, because that's where the cock-up happened, technological cock-up happened. And it's very wordy, and there's no soundtrack at all.
There's no music at all.
And it's shot so in black and white, shadows, lots of close-ups with to mouths, to eyes. It's really, really intense.
No, I remember noticing the sweat on Larry Hagman's lip as we went on, and it was like, oh gosh, yeah, that's like a really interesting detail. You know, he's clearly under this pressure. There were a few subplots that I was slightly not baffled by, but I found them interesting. So one of the key generals, the one who's supposed to give the order, has alcoholic parents.
Oh, the colonel. Yeah, that is a bit odd, really. That he does have alcoholic parents, of whom he's very ashamed.
Of whom he's very ashamed, and he's found by his senior officer.
Yes.
Because he's gone missing and he's suddenly needed. And he goes to the address that he's at, and there are his alcoholic parents living in, you know, poverty and slovenliness. Yeah. And and then he has a breakdown.
I think that's meant to be part of the reason why he has a breakdown, I think.
Well, it's interesting because the senior officer says anybody could have had a breakdown under those circumstances. Yeah. And so I think there's quite a lesson there in, you know, this is not because of the alcoholism. It's not because of his hereditary. You know, it's that under those circumstances, one in two of us would probably crack.
Yeah, I mean, I think possibly. I haven't read the original novel, but one of the co-authors, Eugene Burdick, I've read. He writes in the 1960s. He wrote really quite high level thrillers, quite intelligent thrillers. I think maybe that was kind of an after effect of the adaptation, that really you didn't really need to know that he had alcoholic parents. It was kind of a bit pointless in terms of the actual story, because, as you say, I mean, you could argue, oh, it's because he was the stress of having alcoholic parents, he'd been exposed to a senior officer, that might have contributed. But then the senior officer says what you say, it, you know, anybody would have cracked. And there's also evidence the Russians are cracking up. I mean, everyone's cracking up.
Yeah,
you know,
there was a yeah, there was an opposition major or general or something in the Russian army for whom a similar thing had happened. So that was quite interesting.
Yes.
There's also before, so it starts with a dream about a bullfight.
Yes.
Which was, I didn't really get that metaphor, I have to be honest. That
I
may
didn't
be
either.
Something that's very 60s, because I know that bullfighting was used in lots of sort of metaphorical ways around masculinity in more 60s writing. That it's not my particular genre. The guy who has that dream is also the guy who then goes on to fly the plane that bombs New York.
Yes, where
and
his wife and children live.
His wife and children live. He takes the cyanide capsule as he's doing that, and his last words are, "I am the Matador."
Yeah, I mean, I think that the dream was, because he's General Black, or Blackie, as they call him. Yeah, although he's a military man, he's actually the dove in this whole thing. He's the one that sees the danger of accumulating a never-ending pile of nuclear weapons, and he's one that wants to de-escalate this whole thing. And he's clearly concerned about the job that he has, which is, you know, as a senior advisor in the Department of Defense. And he starts and he talks to his wife when he wakes up. I've had that dream again. He's always having this dream. I really should give up my job. And I think he fears that he might be the bull or something like he's the thing that's being killed. And that's why he thinks when he finally sees the final version of the dream, that's when he dies, you know. But it, then it turns out that he's the matador. He's the one that is killing all these people, including his children and the wife that he loves so dearly. So that might be it. But, you know, yeah, the matador thing was a bit of a trope for its day. And it's probably doesn't travel very well these days.
I think let's turn to Walter Matthau's character, who is obviously what's inspired this.
Oh, yes.
So at the start, he's basically mouthing off at a dinner party, a cocktail party.
A Washington,
About how basically, I mean, it's essentially, it is the Kissinger position, isn't it? Peace through strength, domino theory, the whole lot.
You can win a nuclear war.
Yeah, you can win a nuclear war, but you have to go first. And there's a bizarre moment where a very drunk woman tries to sleep with him and he's not interested.
I didn't really understand that. I mean, she was getting off on him talking about 40 million people dying in the United States as a victory for the United States.
Yeah.
So if it's 40 million, it's all right. 60 million, you know, but we can still win it. And she was clearly getting all horny about that. And she wanted to get off with him. And then he slaps her. But I think that was, I mean, it was a bit, that was a bit obscure, but I think he was trying to indicate that he was basically someone that would do this and she was just getting off on it. You know, it was a bit weird, but it was one, it's the only sexual element in the whole film. And I didn't quite understand it.
It felt very jarringly out of place. And I'm wondering if they just had to put in some sort of sexy element because that's what you had to have in a film.
Yes.
But the main thing is that when once this accident is clear and once we know what's happening, the president, the Pentagon, the generals, all the military people are immediately trying to stop it, up to and including bombing their own bombers. Yeah, they would quite happily see their own planes shot down. In fact, there is a moment where one of their planes is shot down and cheering breaks out in the Pentagon until someone points out that that's a dead American soldier. But this guy, he's like, take advantage of the accident, let it happen, and let everything fly. Go for the big win.
Yeah, I mean, and this is listener Walter Matthau at. Just he was approaching his peak, right, as an actor, and he's I mean, I don't really associate Walter Matthau with being sexy, really, or being really hip and cool. But this is him being, you know, he really is a complete bastard. He is the realpolitik kind of political analysis in a dinner jacket, because that's where he starts in a dinner jacket. So he's kind of hip and cool and a complete bloodless freak. I don't think we're meant to, you know, because Blackie is the dove being the general.
And he is
the darkness. He is and does reflect. I mean, in retrospect, he isn't just based on Henry Kissinger. There are other people he might have been based on too. But nonetheless, he is the one that sees nuclear weapons as just another tool in the great game between great states.
But it's not just nuclear weapons that he sees as a tool, it's death tolls.
Yeah.
You know, it's almost like the kind of effective altruism thing where it says, well, it's much better to kill X number of people here because you know, Y number of people, and it's just so bloodless.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, a lot of that is exactly what Henry Kissinger was perpetuating.
And others, it wasn't just Kissinger at this time. And the interesting thing is that he's not. Well, I don't think we're meant to be sympathetic to the. And can you pronounce the name of, because he's a professor, he's an academic, Professor Gruttschel. I've had to practice his surname because when people say it in the film, they go but it's Gruttschel, Professor Gruttschel. he refers to the fact that, you know, when he's challenged about his views, I mean, first of all, there's this great quote when he's challenged that he thought 60 million dead was acceptable. And because I wrote it down, he said, "I'm not a poet. I'm a political scientist."
Yeah. God damn it.
It's a great line for a man who just want to sign off 60 million dead as acceptable. But there is, you know, he does say, well, you know, when he's challenged about all of this, he said, well, essentially, we've got to use these weapons because he is a Cold War warrior who does seem to be ideologically clear about the evil of Marxism, the evil of Moscow, what they will do to us.
Of communists are not human in his opinion at all.
Yes.
They've had all that is human stripped out of them. And then, of course, you have the conversations between the Moscow president, the president, and Larry Hagman. And clearly, very, very human level conversations.
Yes. I mean, towards the end, when there's, you know, one, I don't know, an Air Force general is having a conversation with his counterpart in Moscow, because in the end, the Americans try to tell the Russians all the things that they need to do to help them shoot down those bombers, right? So, and then his counterpart keels over with a heart attack, so he has to talk to somebody else in Moscow because the guy realizes he's just made a terrible mistake, which is allowing the bomber to get through. So he's replaced by someone, and then the Air Force general is looking at the personnel file for the person he's talking to, and then discovers that during the Second War, both of them were stationed in London. Like London, and oh, it was so nice. And, you know, so clearly it's making a point that the Russians and the Americans are both humans.
It's almost like a Sting song.
That one. Yeah, well, I don't really want to go through that. So I think the point of the film is, I mean, they make a lot of, there's a lot of points about its technology, the mechanics. Can the humans be in control of any of this? And the point being that they can't. That's the point of the film, really. They can't. And we need to do something about it. And, I mean, Sidney Lumet, I mean, he didn't write it, but he directed it. I mean, he's kind of, you know, a Hollywood liberal, did 12 Angry Men, did all kinds of brilliant films. And the message was really, you know, we're all human beings, and we need to sort of sort this out before it kills everybody, not just people in New York and Moscow.
Sidney Lumet did one of my favorite films, which we should probably cover at some point, which is Running on Empty.
Oh, right. I've not come across that.
Oh, it's a wonderful film. It's about two people who blew up a napalm lab during the Vietnam War and have been on the run ever since. And their children have gone from being, one of them was four at the time and the other was born on the run, and they've always sort of been on the run.
Right.
And okay. River Phoenix plays the older son.
Right, I'll look that one up. Because I know, I'm known more particularly as like 12 Angry Men, The Pawnbroker.
I don't know The Pawnbroker. 12 Angry Men's a fantastic film.
Talk about harrowing The Pawnbroker. He does harrowing quite well. And Network, which I don't think we've done.
No, I don't think we have.
Later on. So I'll look that one up. So, but going back to The Pawnbroker, because The Pawnbroker is a, you know, it's Rod Steiger's probably best ever film. And he's playing someone who has survived the Holocaust, but lost his family to the Holocaust. And he's sort of 25 years later in New York. And he's been trying to forget about it. And then he starts to relive it. And, you know, that was around about the time of this film, in the episode just before it. But the interesting thing, because this is why I'm bringing it now back to Professor Grütterschall, that in his defense, when he's talking, because he's seeing the Russians, these horrible, inhuman kind of Marxists who will do anything they possibly can to get the advantage and to kill you, he basically makes a comparison with, well, and I'm assuming, you know, given his name, he's meant to be from, at least in origins, Europe, a bit like Central Europe, probably like Henry Kissinger. Whether he's Jewish or not, it's never made apparent. But he's basically says, well, if the Jews, you know, had turned
and had
around
guns.
And had guns and used them, would there have been so many dead Jews? So he's definitely got a rationality to it, whether it's one we agree with or not. So he's
which
not,
is
he's
a,
not
a, what is largely said about Kissinger as well, isn't it? That, you know, his worldview was very much shaped through the fact that he was a World War II survivor.
Yes. As might it, as you know, might it will, you know, you would think it would be odd if it didn't.
I mean, Kissinger is to blame for lots of things. Mostly, I blame him for the fact that Tom Lehrer retired when he won the Nobel Peace Prize because he said nothing is funny anymore. And I love Tom Lehrer.
Right, right. Yes, I think there are other crimes that might be added to the list.
I mean, yeah, one or two. Yeah, I mean, Milei and the whole of Cambodia.
I mean, he wasn't directly responsible for that. I think that was a bit of freelancing by some by that. Oh, I've forgotten his. I used to know the name of the American officer that did it, Casey or anyway, it doesn't matter. But yes, for the bombing of Cambodia, and
yeah,
I mean, yeah, terrible human being slash. Savior of humanity. Apparently, some people think that. Very, very disturbingly, how some people think that. So, yeah, that was not the first time I saw the film, Emma. And I remember the first time, and it did leave me quite devastated for a little while. Well, how did you? This was the first time you'd seen it.
First time I'd seen it. I watched it in two halves, if I'm honest, just because of timing. But I'd intended to watch it in three parts, but this, I just couldn't stop watching the second half. I thought it was absolutely brilliant. But
yes.
Yeah, bleak. Bleak is not wrong, Amazon Prime.
Yes. Cerebral too, Amazon Prime. It is an intelligent film. It's a very intelligent film.
I thought, so right at the very end, when they're about to bomb New York, they show street scenes of New York.
Yeah.
And it was really interesting because it's for 64, it's quite progressive, it's very multicultural. And that scene is clearly like the all human life is here and about to be extinguished kind of thing. And it really, I mean, I was in tears at the end. And I get that it was, you know, the deal. You know, it was the lesser of two evil options. But that still doesn't mean that, you know, I mean, you were still seeing a city that I happen to absolutely love being nuked. And I, mm-hmm. you know, 11 years before I was born. So, yeah, and it was, but I thought the human choices depicted in it were so beautifully done. And the bomber, the one who's bombing Russia, and his absolute refusal to believe anything he's being told by the human beings who are trying to pull him back.
Because he's been
up
trained.
To and including his wife.
His wife screaming, you know, just trying to get him to stop, to sort of turn back, to just not bomb. But he's training. That I think that was the kind of the ultimate message of the whole thing was that, you know, machines control things and men have been turned into machines.
Mm.
So that there's no human element. I mean, because his training was, you know, when after a certain point, when you start hearing, if you get radio messages from certain people, don't believe it because the Russians are probably doing it. So he turns down his president and he ignores his wife. And in the end, the air crew are kind of irradiated before they bomb, and they decide they're just going to die with the whole thing. So no, they don't come out of it alive.
No.
So yes, it's not a happy feel-good film for the Christmas period, but it might help you decontaminate, as it were, from some of the saccharin stuff that might be flying around.
Well, I don't know. I'm going to go and watch Scrooge now.
Oh, for God's sake. But quite how audiences in 1964 saw it, as I say, audiences were shaped by Doctor Strangelove.
Which I, of course, have never seen. So I've come to this one first.
Which you've revealed you've never seen, which I just find quite staggering, really. But they would have been shaped by that up to a point. But it came out in 64, came out in October 64, during the course of the American presidential campaign, when one of the presidential candidates, Barry Goldwater, seemed to be an advocate of first strike nuclear war, right? So how scary would that have been? I mean, obviously, he didn't win, I don't know what Donald Trump's position is on the first strikes. He'll probably do it just for the hell of it,
inconsistent, I suspect. Yeah.
Might destroy property prices, so he's against it for that reason. So those were scary times. This was only 2 years after the Cuban Missile Crisis as well. So I can only imagine what it must have been like for
the nuclear paranoia was at its absolute highest.
Yeah. And I mean, even now that has passed, although, you know, Putin kind of threatened to use nuclear weapons if things were accelerated, you know, support was accelerated for the for Ukraine. So that kind of brought things back, and it still could happen. But I wonder how audiences now would just see this. But I think it works. I mean, I've watched it a couple of times knowing what the ending was. And now, listener, you know what the ending was. And it doesn't really make that much of a difference, at least to me, in terms of, you know, appreciating it as a film and as a drama and as a dilemma.
Yeah, I think there's so much in there. I don't think knowing how it ends would spoil any of the journey to that ending. And I think there are nuances that you could pick up knowing how it ends on a second watching.
Yes, which I don't get the impression you will want to do anytime soon.
I mean, it was very, very good and I'm glad I've seen it, but
yes.
I now wish it to not be in my head.
Right. Well, maybe you should watch Doctor Strangelove.
Maybe that's the antidote.
Or, as you say, watch Scrooged. So that's...
Or Scrooged, which is... And listeners can go back, because I believe we did an episode on Scrooged.
We did. We did. Yes,
as a Christmas special a few years ago. It's a bit more Christmassy Christmas special.
Yes, no, I like that one. So anyway, I think that's us, isn't it?
I think so.
I'm all spoken out. So thank you for listening, listener. And if I remember rightly, this has been a Political Human production. The theme tune is the creation of Lord Stuart Wood. And if you want to rate and review us on whatever platform you may be listening to us on, then that would be nice.
Bab, thank you so much, and Merry Christmas, everyone.
Particularly for listening at Easter.